What happens now? Okay. Welcome everyone to this episode 149 of Extinction RT, and I'm joined here today with Pradeep from the Indian subcontinent. Hello, Pradeep.
Hello, namaste.
Namaste. And yeah, I think we can just carry on where we left off. You were talking about some 25-year-old happenings in Serbia, I think.
There's just too much, and now to it's the entire, sort of the theater is expanding, theater of war. War drums are on, preparations and all. So, but in Greenland, like, how is it? Like, I think it's very safe. Nobody will.
Yes, we had a little stint of drama during the Second World War, but that was like one very remote meteorological station that was first burned down by the Germans and then bombed by America, but that was like in an area where only polar bears live, you know, so it's like way up on the northeast coast or something. And yeah, war in Greenland, it wasn't really didn't really get started, I think. I think it was too far away. Greenland has an interesting history with the European Union because I think about 25 years before the Brexit, before the British exited the EU, Greenland voted to exit the EU before it was even a union. So they got out of the union in the
Pioneer, pioneer.
1980s. Early 1980s, so they are the OG, the original exiters, is the Greenland exit. But I think for NATO, it's just a part of NATO simply because Denmark has the kingdom over it. You know, so it's like we don't have an army, but we have some kind of navy function of Denmark that is doing civilian jobs up here, like tsunamis or avalanches and that kind
Natural
of thing. It's a mostly civilian force
disaster
up here, but
management.
of course, obviously, if somebody would want to occupy or invade, then all of NATO would of course be a part of defense, but it's
Because
just not.
Trump once said he wants to buy Greenland. Trump.
I think Americans are actually quite interested because of the resource situation. You know, we have all the new green minerals or whatever you call them.
Yes, absolutely. It's urgent.
And we even have another very scarce resource, which is sand, or sand that can be used in electronics and stuff. We have when our glaciers glide on the bedrock, they leave this very, very fine sort of type of sand. And when the glaciers retreat, you get it becomes available, and it rolls with the wind, and
Silicon, it's in used in IT, in I mean for silicon and all.
You can, I think you can use it for solar panels and that kind of stuff as well. But I don't quite see it as kind of the geopolitical hub of interest, or I think the crazy times will come to other places before it comes to Greenland.
Because, I mean, for sure this year, it is I mean, many more wars will start. There are already two or three, and I think another will be more than half a dozen by the end of the year.
Half a dozen what? Sorry?
More wars. I mean, total number of wars, fronts. Mm-hmm. Like now we have Israel and Gaza and Russia, Ukraine. Then soon Iran, Israel may start. I mean, so like this, half a dozen theaters at least will be there by end of the year, if not more. Mm-hmm. Because it can start broadening very fast also. I mean, the way I see it, because the trend is very, very, I mean, it's a tinderbox kind of situation.
Yes, but I think at the same time, everybody, you know, all the big countries, they know, they have been wargaming this for, you know, for decades, and they are fully aware how easy it is to, you know, just set everything in place. But it's kind of a, you know, like the game of chicken, where two cars are running towards each other. And especially young guys, right? And I want to play this game to see who gets in first. Yeah, who goes to the sides first, and they lose. And so it's kind of a, you know, as above, so below kind of thing. If people are stupid when they are kids, they are stupid when they are grown up. Or the same kind of stupid exists in the macro society. In the kindergarten, you know. So it's kind of a two cocky young guys who are driving their American car towards each other, and I think it's always been like that, hasn't it? Also, you've had wars for thousands of years, and
with the advent of, I think, technology and basically this human nature, what all is playing out, it's human nature. And every now and then, I think human nature moves simultaneously towards a hubris kind of a situation. And and in this one, it is not only human nature. I think everything is collapsing at the same time. I mean, the wars are all starting geopolitically. Then you see climate. Climate also is reaching its fag end, you know, the frequency and intensity of major events are increasing, and record temperatures and record highs and lows are being created at a higher level every day. I mean, the way we are moving. And then you see soon, there'll be food shortages in many places. Another 1.5 years from now, 2 years. Food shortages will start, then civil unrest. So it's really a very crazy situation. We really don't know. And all kinds of, like, solar, they've started some in small experiments of solar re-engineering. some states.
In one sense, I think the human condition, the human situation has always been kind of a knife to the throat. You know, 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, there were lions and tigers all over the place, and you couldn't just let your kids out to play because they would be eaten by some kind of fierce creature. And so I think, yeah, it's a special situation that we are in now, but in some other way, it has always been.
Once the Industrial Revolution took place, it was a runaway year for humans, you know, to conquer all the other species, to kill all the species, to take over all the geographical area around, and the colonization started. And then, technology has taken over now. And that is really pushing us. I mean, this emissions and all are all technology-driven, like human-induced. So everything is conspiring. Actually, everything is coming to a, you know, like a point where everything is going to collapse at the same time.
It's all. But that was also pre-told, I think, in 1971, 72. You had the Stockholm Conference, and you had the Limits to Growth book or report. And they, even then, 52 years ago, whatever, they saw that the 2020s, that was sort of the breaking point for many of these curves or graphs, that they would come to some kind of critical point in our days. You mentioned the Industrial Revolution, and that started in the 1700s, right? The
1750, roughly.
So I looked into some of the graphs for temperature, because you had, of course, the Little Ice Age, right?
Was about 10,000 years, 12,000 years ago.
Yeah, so the glaciers were, they call that, expanding. They were coming further down from the mountains and, replacing farms, destroying farms in their way. And
creating rivers also.
Yeah, and then because of the trajectory of the Earth around the Sun and how close we are to the Sun, that kind of thing, it started getting warmer after we came out of the Little Ice Age, and those were the days. This was before the Industrial Revolution started, so the planet warming up from being placed differently to the Sun.
There have been several curves up and down in the planet.
But my point is that the warming up that we got from from Sun and astronomical things that triggered the biological response on the planet, where we release more natural CO2. Carbon dioxide, and because it went on for hundreds of years, we were in this warmer phase. You come to a point where there's been so much more CO2 that in itself creates increased warming. So it's sort of a two-way situation. And then on top of that, we found the British, especially found coal. They started using coal and built the railways made factories based on coal and these steam engines and all that kind of stuff.
So and even coal is one of the biggest contributors of energy in the world today also.
Yeah, absolutely. People believe that we stopped using coal. No, we never use as much coal as we do today, I think.
And coal usage is going to increase even more in the next 6-8 years. And so it's absolutely, it's something like, everything is destined, it's like a play, and it's all, the things are happening as we watch, like a disembodied creature or something from outside, if you look at it like in a non-dualistic framework, actually this whole thing is a drama also. Like if you look at it, we are just a little speck, 8 billion people on a planet which is one of the solar system, which is one of the Milky Way, and which is one of the so many Milky Ways. And here in this world, we in 270 years or 300 years, we managed to wipe it out.
I think it's
Even biological, like even biological warfare, I mean, things might start happening worse than COVID, they're saying.
I think it's interesting what you do when you're looking at it like a drama, because you know every different angle to look at the whole thing from may tell you something more or
No,
something
actually,
else.
like actually, our whole thing, you know, this whole thing about our the way like our philosophy goes, you know, that at the peak, actually, I mean, we are all part of one. I mean, we are not like there's no separate I, me, mine. You know, actually, the whole thing is we are just cellular, I mean, mass of cellular here with a working mind, part of a bigger scheme of things, like our lila and in some and there's so I mean we just go off. I mean, just a part of it maybe survives as part of a greater consciousness or anything, but we are not. I mean. That's what our, I mean, the whole thing is. So if you just are, I mean, then you watch the whole thing like a spectacle, like you're just watching a year, like a drama unfold. And then you know the drama has its particular ways, you know, it's all cyclical. And so, like, we are meeting a explosive end in, say, 10 years from now, 15 years or less.
But what do you think about the politicians and people within the climate narrative, because they have been saying that this is situation is so serious, we have to do something. And then at the same time, the same politicians go and say, "No, we have to bomb Iran and do these other things first. You have to invade Moscow
See,
and Iran."
all these decisions should have been taken in the 60s. In the 60s, when the first reports were given to the US presidents that time, I mean, then nobody could fight against the huge lobbies of energy. See, Rockefeller and all these people, you know, the energy world, Rothschild, yeah, so they rule the world. So they really don't care. I mean, see, all they see is, I mean, I think also we are very gullible as humans. We were the ones who bought the cars. I mean, we are the ones who like that lifestyle. So we all added to it, that's all.
I think in the 1960s, I think the oil companies themselves had climate specialists, climate experts who were studying it to look into how big or destructive it would be. And I wasn't born in the 60s, but I think their conclusion was that it would be pretty destructive, but far away in the future, like say in the 2020s, right?
Yeah, they never thought it was so fast, but they had enough evidence to show that what it can lead to. I mean, if this whole, I mean the 60s, you know, the great cut, I mean the whole paradigm of cars and aviation and everything. I mean, flying, 5-star hotels, and the whole thing has become like a, you know, like a magnet, you know, like which has lured people in this our civilization.
Yes, I think in one of my essays, when I looked into the Stockholm conference and when this climate thing sort of became a thing that was discussed, was discussed in parliaments and stuff.
Acha.
So one of those kind of thought points in an upcoming essay. For me, was when they put it up on the whiteboard, blackboard, as a problem, as an issue. Was it already too late to fix it? You know, if what they're saying is correct, you know, if the problematique as they described it was valid, and it was an issue to be, you know, to be facing and struggling with, as they say within the narrative, was it then by definition already too late to handle? And if it was, then we can ask ourselves, why did they start pretending that it was all in our hands? You know, if they already knew, if the oil companies already had experts who knew how self-reinforcing and stuff it would be, and if the, let's say, good guys on the socialist left green side of it, things in the 1970s, if they also knew that, or the smartest of them knew that it was, by their own definitions, a runaway train in 1972. You know, if all of these things were the case, then were they just trying to put up a big show, a big, you know, a big illusion? Because that's kind of how it feels to me. I've been interested in the climate since the 1980s, the later half of the 1980s, you know, after Chernobyl and stuff. It seems to me they've never really tried. They never, ever tried to put this back in the box or whatever you say, you know, to fix the alleged problem. I've never seen them trying, and I think, at least as a young man and a teenager in my past, it was very, very annoying and very maddening, I think, to just see them talk about it and doing nothing about it.
Yeah, it can be, it must have been great. I mean, really difficult.
Yeah.
Actually, the whole thing, I think, so it started with the 60s. Counter-revolution time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they saw it, I mean, and they really wanted to stop this whole thing. And Nixon was totally against it. And I think at a global level, that led a lot, you know, like it meant, I mean, I think it sort of, otherwise, I mean, there wouldn't have been so much of capitalism, let's put it that way. Just hankering after more and more. The whole thing is profits and power and geopolitical hegemony and wars and the military-industrial complex. And so I think they're just so powerful. And we are just... And they have also kept us... I mean, most of us see the way they have done it, with lots of Netflix and this and that. So everybody is in a wonderfully drugged out in their own air, and they're all struggling in their own lives in their own air, and lost the big picture totally. And so, and the mainstream media and TV, they don't tell all this at all. So, I mean, even if you tell them, they get, I mean, they find it like irritating to hear such things.
Yeah, I think it seems to me that the next phase in censorship, in the world censorship of different voices, is going to be within the climate field itself, yeah. And they will want to censor everyone, of course, everyone who says it's not a problem will be censored, you know, like they already have been and been looked down upon for, you know, many decades. But in addition to that, they're going to censor people like you, people like Jim Bendel, Roger Hallam, you know, everybody who says that Maybe we cannot fix it, or it will be very, very hard to fix it, or it's way too late. They will also be censored and deplatformed, just like the
It's
so-called
already started
climate
happening.
skeptics and
Already started.
deniers.
Yeah.
Sorry?
It's already started happening, but I'm surprisingly like I have sort of got through till now. I mean, not much of impositions, twice minor period.
Oops. Did you mute?
Yeah, I'm here. No, I'm not mute.
Okay. I'm just going to check with the chat for talk. Okay. So I would just try to tell the people who are in the chat that they can come on here if they want to. There is a link for you watching this now. I posted the link twice in this chat, and you can just click it and choose to come on here and talk with your video on or off. That is the big fantastic technological thing of this internet experience, that you don't have
Yeah.
to just sit in the chat. Right.
Yeah. I saw that. There's no chat over there. I mean,
There's
nobody has chatted.
very little chat, but I don't know. It's probably because of the mistakes I made with this stream. I think some of the people that I thought were able to see it couldn't see it, but I could see it because I'm the owner of the channel, of course. And you know, it's kind of if in order to do this right, you kind of have to be a schizophrenic. Okay, someone is.
That's me.
Someone is. Oh, that's you, of course. No, I was talking about the YouTube chat, the chat on the YouTube that we are streaming to. There are some people, a little bit
Chat.
more people than on
They have
Facebook.
a chat thing on YouTube.
Yeah, there is a chat on YouTube. So I'm trying to be serving them whilst talking on here, which is a kind of a difficult thing to combine. Oh yes, I was thinking talking about people being censored. Think Guy McPherson is the opposite of being censored because he has been on so many television shows that I can't can no longer count them. He used to be all over mainstream media.
Yeah, I mean, so far, he ha was hacked once, I think, or something. I'm not sure.
Okay. They want to know why we are using this meeting software instead of some other meeting software. I think we can have a 5 hour special session after this show with obsolete optics, and we can talk about why we should use a different video conferencing tool. That would be very interesting, I think. But I'm only joking, of course. We use this because it works, and when you guys in the chat figure out how you can click with your mouse on a link in the chat, then you will realize it's possible to come on here and talk as well which is seems
actually
to
be... I do this on my mobile, so
yeah.
I'm a little challenged. I have the laptop. I can do it as well on the laptop. There you say that on the laptop it becomes easier. Like you can do multitasking and all.
And I'm not sure because, as you see, I'm using an iPad to chat with the chatters. I just wish I was more than one person because then I could do these things more easily. You know, if I were two or three more people. Your wish has been fulfilled. You know what the Jitsi is. It's like talking to children, you know. It's like, oh, we don't know what video is, and how can you say that video is moving pictures or whatever. But yeah, I guess back to the people who are in the know. What do you think about the Green New Deal of the European Union, for instance, or
Green Joe Biden? I really don't know that much to. Have a clear idea. I don't have that insight. There are so many other things which have been offered me, like being in the East, and you are talking about a Green Deal between Europe and America.
It's kind of a globalist thing, you know, because America has this Green New Deal something. And then the European Union has a Green New Deal in its bureaucratic way. But Europe is kind of going way further. They are also combining their Green New Deal philosophy with increased, very, very extreme censorship, you know, like... someone like David Icke, he has been denied entry to 30 different European nations just because of his books and his writing. And that is a European Union kind of thing. You know, we had this, what's her name? Von der Leyen, this European politician. German female politician. So she was visiting Greenland, actually, and talking about things like the green transition and these kinds of things, right? But in her speech, she actually said that the main challenge for Europe now is not the Ukraine war, and it's not climate change, she said. The main challenge is disinformation and misinformation. You know, that is kind of the new Nazi slogan or whatever that the Germans are coming with. So it's no longer Ein Volk, Ein Führer, all of that kind of stuff. And now it's disinformation and misinformation, and that's kind of all they ever talk about. And it's, you know, when they talk about it, it's kind of up to us, perhaps, to try and understand what are they planning, you know, why are they doing this, what is going to be so secret 1 year from now that they cannot allow anyone to speak about it, you know. It's, they are preparing the ground for a very, very...
For a more stricter regime ahead.
Absolutely. And the Germans, of course, the Germans are in the forefront of this new regime.
Yeah, so. They've been through it twice.
So,
They must be waiting for one more.
It's kind of strange because she was Tom the Lion. She was here in Greenland, in Nuuk, and they were opening some kind of EU, European Union, educational school centers, something like that, right? Or business corporation, something like that. So she didn't mention the fact that Greenland, after a popular vote, turned down the European Union 45 years ago. She said nothing about that. You know, Norway had two votes where they said no twice, but Greenland only had one referendum about the European Union, and they said absolutely no. So she's opening this EU, Greenland, education, whatever thing, which will be in a building, I think, in an already existing building here in the capital. But I don't really see why it's a thing, because, you know, we're not a part of the union. We are supposed to be outside of the European Union and outside of the Schengen area as well, I think. Because, you know, I think mostly why Greenland is not in the union is because almost everything we do in Greenland is totally impossible within the rules that they have down on the continent, you know, because rules are often derived from the climate and you know, from the temperature and how things are. You know, you don't need the same rules for preserving fish when it's minus 20 degrees outside, you know. So it's kind of a crazy thing to have the same rules from the Arctic to the equator for day-to-day things, you know, like how you work and prepare food and that kind of thing. And
it's totally dependent on the rest of the world for food and everything.
I didn't catch the start of your sentence.
It is totally dependent on the rest of the world for food and other things.
No, the opposite. We make all kinds of food up here that is not considered okay in Brussels, because, you know, we catch seals and whales and walrus and all kinds of seabirds.
And do you export it as well? Do you export it also?
We export some of it, but mostly we export things like fish and, you know, the usual kind of seafood. There's not a lot of people who want whales down in Brussels or in Belgium, or you know, it's like there are exception rules that Greenland sort of is existing under, that you know, every country in the world is against whaling, but there are exceptions for research, you know, from scientific whaling, and also for indigenous whaling, when you whale in order to have something to eat or to have oil for your lamps and heating in your igloo, right? So over the decades, you kind of come to a situation where even eco-activists in London believe that it's Inuits in Greenland who are destroying the planet, you know, because of how they believe vegetarianism and meat eating and how this works and what people are good and what people are evil. So they've come to believe in kind of a bird thinking, that they come to believe that you know, grown men who kill little seals, baby seals, they must be evil, right? But you know, it's like every animal on this planet hunts and kills other animals, and the rest of the animals, they hunt and kill plants, you know. We all got to eat something, and the organisms on the receiving end of the eating are not happy about being eaten, you know. That's kind of very basic philosophy. If people would only study philosophy, they would maybe understand how even the plastic wrapped meat in your shop is killed by somebody. It didn't just grow up in the cooling area in the store. So you have grown up eco activists marching around in London who actually believe that indigenous people and Eskimos, Inuits, whatever you call them, catching their own food on their dog sled or in their kayaks, that they are doing something very destructive to the planet, while these whole foods or whatever
highly carbon intensive countries. They are highly carbon intensive countries, you know.
Absolutely. You have distribution system for all these vegetables that all the green, nice, good activists are running around and eating and serving at their marches and serving at their eco action events. There's a huge apparatus just to get that green food, you know, from the producing farmer and across the planet and to these little nice eco-hippie communities in London and all over the rest of the world, of course. So very absurdly, you kind of get the feeling that, it's those 20,000-30,000 hunters up in Greenland who are destroying everything, who are filling the ocean with plastic and all kinds of things. Yeah, so you talked about yourself as an indigenous, the last part of the indigenous tribes.
Not tribes, like I would like to say, like some put it like this, like we as a race, we have lived for about a recorded history of 14,000 years at least, and even this place, Dam and all, like we have temples over here in this city which are 7 AD. I have the pictures, I can send you, 7 AD, etc. And there are parts of this city where I live, Bhubaneswar, where a war was fought nearby 2,500 years ago, recorded history. And there is history much beyond it also. So it's absolutely, I don't know, I connect a lot. And this is a place where I was born and I stayed away all these years in other parts of India. So I want to stay here and just support this place. It's very spiritual. It's extremely spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think we need more of the spirituality.
I can hold I can prepare a 1 hour year on spirituality.
I looked at one of the chapters from Jem Bendel's latest book during the week, and there's a chapter called The Freedom to Know. I think it was The Freedom to Know. You know, he's talking about the future and he's talking about the situation we're in. And I think maybe you also asked the question last week that what is sort of the purpose of this Sunday gatherings. But what I'm thinking is that, while, of course, we ordinary people, we are not all powerful. We don't control the way the planet goes or anything.
We don't want to. We can't. We don't want to.
No, but kind of the one of the few things that we actually can do is to preserve our freedom to be informed or to know, and not only to know thousands, millions of facts or details, that kind of thing, but to know what is essential, to understand what most of the bullshit is about, For instance, if 99 out of 100 politicians in Europe and America are running around screaming about the green transition, so then that we as sort of normals, I won't claim to be very normal, but you know what I mean, us little people, we can then either run around like headless chicken trying to please the leader and accomplish the transition to the other extremely toxic new future of civilization that they are really talking about, or we can, if we are clued in enough and smart enough and in a smart enough community of other people, we can then maybe understand that this is some kind of death cramp of civilization. They're trying to squeeze the very last lifeblood out of this planet and ecosystem, and making a good profit at the same time. That is sort of what the green transition,
See,
maybe is.
the incremental profits since COVID, the incremental profits have been very high, and it's going only to the top people. So if you see all these ultra-rich people like Bezos and all these people, their wealth has increased since 2020 till now by about 70, 80, and more than 100%, some people. And the poor are getting poorer. The food is not there. If you see like how Americans are struggling, I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, but that was sort of what I did during the COVID crisis, was that if you were not a giant multinational billionaire business, you didn't have 100 lawyers to work for you
Correct,
to
correct.
lobby the government to keep your shop open or your brand stores open. But the normal mom and pop shops down the street in your little town, they only had two or three employees, and none of them were lawyers, right? So they had no way to
Somewhere.
open. And that is kind of where we are going, but of course there is the possibility that people stay informed and get themselves informed so that they can oppose that kind of tyranny that is around the corner. Do you think that's possible for people to,
Like
kick
a
the
civil, yeah, like civil kind of unrest.
It doesn't have to be unrest. It can be more like just saying, no, I'm staying open. My shop is staying open. Our town is going to help each
Then
other.
at a time, there could be like, suppose they are really wanting to become more like authoritative and all, authoritarian, then they'll start pushing the pressure, like.
I think we have seen historically some places in the world, like do you know Crete in the Mediterranean, the island Crete?
Yes.
Because and I think also Sicily, but Sicily has some kind of other thing with the mob, the mafia. But on some of those Mediterranean islands, they've seen so many empires come and go. They've seen so many different invading nations and stuff come and go and taking their little island, right? So after so many centuries of that kind of local history, world history at their place, they basically stopped cooperating with whoever comes from the outside and wants to do something. They just say, yes, I'm going to do that, and then they go the next day to do something else, right? So a kind of non-cooperation.
Non-cooperation without being evil.
Yeah. So maybe that is the thing where we'd have to go. You know, we don't know what the next crisis is going to be. But if somebody comes down your street and wants to close down your local shop, maybe just tell them that, yeah, of course, when do you want me to stop? In 10 minutes? I can stop in 10 minutes. And then you have a neighborhood watch around your town, and somebody on the outskirts tells you, yeah, they've gone back to the capital city now, so you can open the store again, you know?
No, I don't go out or anything. I'm a total recluse. And in fact, I want to change my ancestral village. But my wife, she's not keen on going to a place as quiet as a village, you know, like the ecologically, like zero emission, like emissions will come down like anything. It's a very, lovely year over there. I'm not very hung up about staying in a city or anything. I can just be alone anywhere.
I didn't quite catch.
No, I said I can go and stay in my ancestral village, create a small house and stay there. It's very peaceful. And so you're out of the city, you know, like. And then you have better access to water and food. When the crisis comes, the cities will be hit first.
So you will have more food as well? How does that work?
Like, see, in a rural setting, like you can grow somebody will be growing food, and then you are closer to the sources of food.
Okay, yeah, obviously. Yeah. Yes, it's kind of the same thing, you know. Greenland is basically blue land because all the food comes from the ocean, more or less, you know. So it's kind of, somebody described Greenland as an archipelago, even though it's the biggest island in the world.
Yes.
But the way the settlements and towns are placed around the coast, it's more like an archipelago, like Polynesia, right?
Because you
have to take your kayak and you have to paddle between these different islands or villages. But it's the same that you talk about, that the source of the food is the fjords and the ocean. And people themselves, you know, together with neighbors, can just go out and get a 5-ton whale or whatever, and they have food for 2 months. And the freezing capacities are very good because you can just freeze them right on the beach.
Yeah. It's one big freezer.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also the reason that you are allowed to sell seafowl and meat, just on the pavement outside the big shop downtown. You are allowed the entire year, you're allowed to just stand there with the raw meat and sell it off the pavement. And the reason is obvious. It's because it's below 50, centigrade outside, and most of the season it's even colder, and it's like it's colder than your actual freezer that you're going to take it home.
So actual freezer is -3 or -4.
It's actually very funny if you watch some documentaries of things from Greenland, you can see people having a hole in the ice and fishing, you know, and when they catch fish, they just put it on top of the ice, and within 5 or 10 minutes, that fish is frozen, and you can transport that on your journey further. You don't have to do anything. It's just it's readily frozen, and you need no plastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it's a very strange part of the world.
It's like a reverse of where we live.
Yeah. So for me, fortunately, it's exactly the temperature that I prefer. Like yesterday, I was reading the whole day and my window was open. So it was basically 2 or 3 degrees minus Celsius. And I had to take off almost all my clothes while I was reading with my window open. Because, I don't know.
I believe that after, not nude, no. But you are used to that temperature.
Yeah, like t-shirt, reading in my t-shirt in around 0 Celsius, something.
Gotcha.
I'm kind of thinking that over the centuries, over the millennia, people who came from Africa and went in different directions, north, south, east, west, they kind of became acclimatized or something. They kind of slowly became used to whatever temperature they had in that area. People like me, my father perhaps, if it's over 25 degrees on the plus side, that's like nothing we want to be around, right? But maybe for you guys, you start freezing and catch a cold if it's colder than 25. I don't know.
I've seen Chicago when it's quite cold. Minus 15 feels like minus 25. Okay. And it's quite cold.
A very windy city, isn't it? It's called
a windy city.
I think one of the coldest cities I've been to is Bergen, you know, in Norway, where I was born. Because in Bergen, there's always some kind of drizzle or precipitation in the air. And when it's wet and some kind of cold wind or something, then maybe plus 5 degrees. It feels like minus 20 or something, you know, because it gets in from, even if you're walking, fishing, and you have rain gear and everything, it gets into your clothes from the bottom of your trousers. It comes from the side and from below, and, you know, it's just all over, you know, that kind of drizzle. Many times in the colder eastern parts of Scandinavia, you can have minus 10, minus 20, minus 30, but it's kind of a quiet, wind-free cold. As long as you're not jumping into the lake or
One of my favorite directors is a Swedish director called Ingmar Bergman. Absolutely. Ingmar Bergman.
Great guy.
His movies are also set in these very solitary places, like
mm-hmm.
some of his movies.
Right. I don't know. Are we going to try to... Will we get somebody to come on
here? I think I'll just push off for a while. Then I need to catch up with my news and all, you know, like I have 2-3 news channels, like those Oblique, which gives the real news of the world. So I get the pulse of what's happening, and then that helps me in the next days, like whatever I post and all.
Yeah, I think maybe I will post another thing on the Extinctionati Substack, I mentioned some of it with the climate narrative, maybe being willfully false or already from the get-go in 1972. So maybe I will clean up that essay a bit and post it on the Substack.
Yeah.
And then just maybe take it from there next Sunday. I don't know.
All right.
Yeah?
Yeah, next Sunday I'll be going out also, but I should come back by 8 or so. But it'd be like a little tough on me, but well, I'm like 72 plus. How old are you?
How old? I can't really remember. I think I'm somewhere around 52, maybe 53.
And then much fitter, like, see. I mean, a very fit 62, and I'm like a aging, demented.
Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe you are have the best health.